Okay, so you know I'm Barron. I'm the chair of the Elderberries, and this is Don.
Stand up. I've been around forever. I've been through just about every phase of gay life that there is. We started off vanilla. We got into leather. We got into rubber. We got into the fetishes. And way back when, I used to organize. Like, I think one of my first projects was the Over 30s, which I inherited. I had for 15 years. It was a potluck supper for men. We eventually got into the ladies and the men were on opposite sides of the room. Have you ever had that? Of course you have. High school, way back where? Yeah, it happens all the time. It happened with our society. The women were on this side. The men are on this side. The only time they came together was for the meal. And then they rotated around this table and went back to their... Yeah, so that's the type of community that I started up in. Now, I have also carried dresses. I have been with a couple of drag queens because that's where I thought gay life was. When I first came out, it was like, oh yeah, I need a girlfriend, because I came from a straight sort of orientation. Now, that is cool, and all that is good, but you get tired of carrying somebody else's dresses when she's getting all the attention. It's like, I'm sort of still gay, so I changed from carrying dresses to getting into leather and wearing my own outfit. And, yeah, I was decked out, and that's when I started traveling and went to Chicago, got into all that, and that's where the headquarters of most of the leather folks are. And mind you, San Francisco is also a very good spot. Yes, but the International Mr. Leather was also good. I was also president of the Mac Leather Association, which sent people, winners, to Chicago for the International Mr. Leather. It's like a whole different story whatsoever. And from, let's go back to when I started the Over 30s, the potluck. Oh, there's a ton of different people, different personalities. We did not discriminate. We didn't have old folks and young folks. We just had anyone that was over 30 and wanted to come out to a potluck supper. And we had them all over the place. The biggest thing and the biggest problem was finding a place to hold 60 people. Now, I live in a house that holds 60 people, but it's hip to hip. It's like I live in a little house with my partner who I've been with for 35 years. And it's like, that's all good, and it's all great, and it's like an old married couple. That's why he's not here today, and I am. So it's like, yeah. All right.
Okay. Well, how about
introduce myself enough?
Yeah.
Let's go that way. Nancy, you're on.
Hi, I'm Nancy McKinnell, and I have lived in Halifax since 1991. I don't think I'm going to go quite to that degree, but anyway, it'll all come out as it does. But I had a fairly traditional life, and ended up with two marriages and a kid, and you know, sort of. Anyway, so when I was asked to come today, I thought, oh, I feel like a bit like a fraudulent lesbian. And then I started thinking about my life, and then decided, no, I actually am not a fraud. I am a real lesbian. And anyway, I'm happy to be here, and I'm curious to see where this conversation goes.
Hi, my name's David LeBlanc. Moved to Halifax 1986 or so. Just kind of always been on the sidelines here and there, so nothing special, nothing big for achievements in particular, I don't think.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Now, I want to start with something that I wouldn't say it's light, but it's not really a downer. It's like, who was your first gay or lesbian friend?
Whoa.
Tell us about them. What, you know, how did that mean anything to you? Was it just a one-shot deal? Or who was the first one that really meant something to you? Put it that way.
That's a whole different story. Is it my first encounter you want to hear?
No, these are the people that are talking, not us.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Great around. Start over here. You had a first, right? Yeah, all right. There we go. We got a smile out of him. All right.
First gay person I knew besides myself, or
it's up to you.
Small, but someone who was significant to you and that made a difference in your life.
Probably, I have a queer family, and so kind of I can't really think of one or the start of anything. Just by been around most of my life.
Oh yeah.
So. Main experience one would be, I think when I was like my late teens, so that would have been 70s, 60s, something. I'm not aging myself here today.
Baron, I obviously completely failed to communicate. These actually are the storytellers here.
Yeah.
Oh.
I was trying to get to that, but he was directing.
We'll do this set of storytellers.
Okay.
And then at the end of the hour, we'll take a bio break. Oh, I should have done that intro. Did we do the intro with the land acknowledgement?
Oh, no, we didn't. No, I can do that.
That's why I do it in
process. Yeah. We acknowledge that this is the ancestral home of the Mi'kma'ki. We live, love, laugh, and play and work on unceded territory. We are all treaty people. I'm Dan McKay, very amateur historian and publisher. This is Jess Wilton. Weber, Jess Weber, sorry.
There she is.
Who is a professional historian. Jess, do you want to do like a 30-second introduction to your project when I get through here?
Sure.
Okay. So the format today is people telling stories. At the front of the room, we'll have storytellers, and we have two ideas in mind. One, as Baron said, is Mi'kmaq people sitting in during long winter nights, entertaining each other and passing stories on from one generation to the other. And the other idea is the grand salons of New York in the 1930s with Alice B. Toklas and Gertrude Stein at the front of a table and everybody else listening to them say witty things. And Oscar Wilde, Toulouse-Lautrec, Magnus Hirschfeld, Edna St. Vincent Millay, and that kind of crowd. So this is
okay.
You can pick whether you're Edna St. Vincent Millay or...
Why not do something related, and how do you relate to the gay situation or the trans situation?
Yeah.
And where did the history come from?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Baron is your moderator, and then the big format is that reminds me of a story. So one person tells a story, and someone else says that reminds me of a story. That's it for me. Jess, do you want to talk about your story, your project?
I want to talk about my story. Not now. Well, I don't want to talk about my project. I'll give you the very short version of it. I am Jess. I'm working with the Dark Heritage Museum with a grant from the Department of Canadian Heritage to make an 8-part documentary series on the US LGBTQ+ community in HRM. So I haven't talked to you yet. Feel free to come to talk to me. We can go from there. I'm just doing videos and sitting and chatting with people pretty much like this is, but one-on-one, all over the city.
So there's food indoors and outdoors during breaks. Go out and fill your plates. There's hot dogs on the barbecue and many other things. Plenty to have a seat. People will be wandering in. That's part of the process. Washroom is there. There's a bunch of stuff from the archives, miscellaneous stuff from the archives over there for you to riffle through. All of it is there. It's duplicate material from the archives, so feel free to riffle through it and get your greasy hands on it. That's what it's for.
We're recording this in two different ways, video recorder there, and I have an audio recorder here. Those audio recordings, it turns out, we've been doing this series for a while, and the audio recordings, it turns out, are super important, and having these voices and these stories captured is just amazing. And we've got a guest book, but maybe I'll come up with something before you do. Also in the corner there, there's a yellow pamphlet, which we just published this year, which is a story of how the LGBT community in Halifax gelled up in 1971-1972. It's a pretty good story. You guys have all heard the story of how Stonewall happened in New York. This is just as good. Halifax is just as good. And a brochure for the elder areas as well. That's it for me. Okay. Yes.
Can we leave that door open by chance, just so there's more air circulation?
Yeah,
or did you close it?
No. But it's a squeak, too. Yeah, leave it.
I would just like the air.
I know. Yeah. That's true.
Better circulation. Okay. It was something you might want to bring up. Then it said 1971. There was a movie made in Halifax, Siege. In 1971. It was about the gay community.
Oh, yeah. I never heard of it. No,
me neither.
Never heard of it.
Well, maybe you could tell us about that, Siege.
Yeah.
It was a film made about the gay community in Metro?
It was made early 70s. I think it was during the police strike. It was based on an event that happened at the Turret. There was some gay people, they ran for cover just down around the corner. To a building that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. And they were held up there, siege.
And does everyone know what the Turret is?
The Turret was a bar that was on Barrington Street between Sackville and Blowers.
Yeah.
And Blowers.
Yeah.
Just before Spring Garden Road.
Yeah. And it was the second gay bar in town?
Was it? It was before my time.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Related to, I believe. There was one right across the street. Where
D Club.
Yeah. And before that.
It was called D Club. T-H-E-E. D Club.
Yeah.
And they had tin cans on the wall with perforations for chandeliers. It was tacky. But it was fun because the music was great.
Yes.
And you felt like I could be free here. Mm-hmm. You know, girls dancing with girls, guys dancing with guys, guys waltzing with guys, girls dancing with girls, you know.
So was that the gay area back in the 70s?
There was no gay area.
No, okay. Because with two bars. And
that was two bars,
yeah.
Would they have been the only two bars at the time?
At the time, yeah, for a long time, yeah.
When did rumors come about?
Once the Turret shut down. Was more condemned than shut down. The fire escape was falling off the wall. Fire marshal came in and said, no, this is not right. So they moved. And they moved down to Granville.
So that's...
And they, just down around the corner. They were down there for several years. Then moved out. I believe that's when...
went up to Goddard.
They were in the old Vogue Theater.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was like way too huge. And they were trying to, I don't know what they were going for, but the space. I think they were actually looking to buy it at one time, or they were getting really cheap rent, one or the other.
I can't remember.
Yeah. But that was where GAE was big. That was the governing party of. The gay community, if that's where the laws, the politics, and all that sort of stem from.
Yeah.
Anyway, when did it die? When did GAE die? When the Eagle came in? And they actually had...
They went through to destroy the profits of the bars, so it was kind of unsustainable because a lot of people were not going out.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to connect because they were terrified. And so there was almost no one on the dance floor, so that means you don't have money coming in to keep the place going. Mm-hmm. The GAA got a financial boost because it had its own club. In the States, all the gay clubs are run by gangsters.
Yeah.
Like right. Stonewall. But we owned our own club and we started our own society, which was a big step because some of those people were working for daycares. Yeah. So when they signed that document, it could have been, you know, the end of their careers. But they got, it was lucrative. People packed the Turret. It was a fun place, but it was too small. I don't think the big rumors was too big, but I think the AIDS crisis killed it because it just wasn't the income.
That's true. Yeah.
But that's just my guess. Anyway.
But I remember Halloween.
Halloween's. The place was spectacular.
Absolutely.
It was the most fun place. Even stray people used to come to our Halloween's because there was, and I think a lot of scared businessmen used to come in costume like once a year and ogle everybody because they didn't have the guts to show up otherwise. But who cares? It was all fun. It was a lot of goofy fun.
Yeah.
And it was safe. It was very safe.
How did the space on Granville come about? Like after leaving the Turret, like how was that space found? It must have been people that were organized.
GAA was just coming into it because I ran something there, Metcalf and Lynn Murphy. Yeah. I remember them both being involved. I think the what was Marilyn?
Oh,
Marilyn.
Big Black Girl. That was the most protection we had.
Gloria.
That was probably the only protection we had. But,
we didn't need anything else.
Yeah, that reminds me down on Granville. I think the reason they moved out of there was because they had an incident where a few of the bouncers from around town actually came down and partied, and everybody got rough. But the problem is, gay people will fight back.
Mm.
And we did have, like, I was a bodybuilder, and, like, I go, 200 pounds now? Well, I was 250, and biceps and all this, and, you know, for a gay guy, it's like, yeah, we're not wimps. It's like, we pick up wimps, but not all of us are. So a few of us got together, and we just pushed, and all these bouncers got pushed out onto the sidewalk. With a few phone calls, police came down immediately, and the whole thing was broken up. Nobody really got hurt. All right, but that was one incident down there that might say that, okay, we want to get out of the downtown core and move a little further up into the gay village, which was happening on Godigan Street.
Mm.
Whether it was or not, there was like everybody was living in that area at the time.
It's kind of sketchy, but it was beginning.
Yeah, it was. It was, well, that's I don't know. That's what I like. I like sleazy. I like, you know, but that's just me, right? It's like I go out and, you know, I'll find a, you know, out of the way motel that's, you know, yeah, anyway. But that's another whole story.
The perception was that was a safer area.
Yeah, that's what we were suspecting. It has happened that Ray Travell got murdered right across the street. Somebody got a day pass from Nova Scotia Hospital, and he was a gay hater, and he picked up this little guy, took him to the parking lot, and beat the shit out of him. Ray came along, helped out, got a stone in the side of the head, and died.
It's right there.
Yeah, anyway, that's part of our history, but it's like a very sad part, because Ray was one of the biggest fans of the gay community. And it was incidents like that that actually sort of came in on itself. And it's like once the gay community doesn't have an outside enemy, it implodes.
Yeah.
Or that's the history that I've seen. What we had was politicians that didn't like us. Hey, that's right up our alley. We'll go for that as long as we have an outside thing that we can focus on. And the gay community is so focused sometimes, it's like blinders. And if they have something to focus on, then the whole community is safe. But if it doesn't, they'll fight amongst themselves all over the place, and it really gets that might have been why the demise came.
I
and then there
pride,
was the single bartender owner type of thing that owned the Eagle as well as Vortex and the bathhouse. I think that was owned by one person as well.
Jim.
Both bathhouses. The one down just across from Spring Garden, right at the bottom of Spring Garden. What was it, Olympia or something? Or
almost across next block up, sort of from where the turret was.
Yeah.
But anyway, the
one guy owned it. I don't remember his name, but he went to Thailand.
Don, you were going to tell us about tightrope and taking a bunch of people out to McNabb's Island. I want to hear that story.
No.
Oh wow.
I drove.
Take a bunch of silly leathermen over to an island and camp out. Okay. Why not? Do I tell them about the?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why not? I got strung out. They had little hooks on some of the leftover paraphernalia over there. And I, of course, being a fetishist, we brought over people that were into tying other people up. So I ended up being tied up, totally naked, and whatever. But that was my highlight. We had war games, like the top of the hill, who can make it up the hill without getting touched or tackled or something like that.
Or hit with the plastic
sword. Yeah, we did that. This is in public ground. It's like, yeah, we don't care. We're leathermen. It's like, we can do what we want, almost. But yeah, that was terrific because it was like probably, what, two dozen? And we went over there, and the meals were fabulous. They were. I mean, you don't go camping without, what was it, those sticky buns. Those great big sticky buns. Oh, my God, yes. That's gay camping. Like, we don't take those little things. It's like, those good ones, yeah. So, yeah, we did it up pretty good. And one of the guys lost a Rolex over there. So it's still there in the bushes somewhere. We looked for it for probably 3/4 of an hour. Didn't find it. So it's like, you probably left it home. Yeah, anyway, it wasn't at home. Still out there on McNabb's Island. And we camped overnight in the old barracks that were there. And it was, you know, I brought an air mattress, of course. Some people, not so much. They had to go out, get branches, trees, cut them down. Here, shave them off. Then they had little things to lay on. But yeah, it was a little tricky. Yeah, that was the first time, and we were out there, what, three times? Something like that? Yeah. But, it's strange, because the leather guys are and were at the opposite end of the, what would you say? The people that do things, okay? The leather people and the drag queens. The drag queens are out there raising money, doing the thing. The leather guys do exactly the same thing. They also have different politics. But you have this apathetic metal that wants to spread to either end. And it's like, okay, you got the guys that are sort of graduating to the leather guys. There's the macho guys, the guys that are motivated to do their thing. And you've got the drag queens in their flowing gowns. And the community sort of divides itself. But it's an apathetic middle. They don't have an opinion of one way or another. So it's like you're there, and it's like, oh, my God, yeah, which way are we going to go? It's like, yeah, who are we going to support? It's like, we're doing our thing. If you want to join us, come along. It was that type of attitude. And the court, of course, with the drag queens, that was that was just fantastic, over the top. The court had its emperor, had an empress. It's like the drag queens were in their glory. This was at the very peak of when the whole community was together, and they could do anything. And this whole throng of people would migrate to them, and they'd come out, and they'd support them. And they wanted to see the gowns. But then that started to go downhill, because some of the empresses couldn't afford a gown to go away. They were raising so much money for the Cancer Society and all the other
nice societies out there that would give them, you know, lots of political, whatever, but they never spent money on themselves. It's like, okay, the leather guys, sure, they bought all their own leather as well. But I would say, okay, if you want the Empress and you want something going on here, all right, send her away, but send her away in style. You've got thousands and thousands of dollars. Spend $100 getting some material so that she can make a nice gown herself. That's all. Mm. That's why I did not participate in the court. I found it not to my liking, but I was into leather at the same time, so it's like, I'll do that thing rather than this thing. So,
Nancy, but anyway. What about you? Did you have some involvement in the politics of the community?
Yeah, not in the same way. I mean, when I... So I first, going back to your very first question about a meaningful gay person, gay or lesbian person, is I had my first kind of relationship when I was 14. And, of course, at the time, well, I don't think I recognized any kind of politics or anything about that that was not okay until we were found out by her father.
Oh.
And then we were in the military at that point, my family and her family was in the military. Her father requested a posting out of where we were living to get her away from me.
Mm.
And that was kind of my first inkling that, something's up here. But I was just having a hell of a great time, and she was teaching me all kinds of amazing things. And but I got the message loud and clear that this was not okay. And so I kind of made a decision at that point that, okay, I guess it's boys. And even though that wasn't quite where I wanted to go, but anyway, over time, there was a long period of time when I it's complicated, right? Because I also had a lot of addiction issues. And so some of my stuff about being a lesbian or being with women, I could write off to, it was because I was drunk. I don't know if anybody else knows about that, but it was kind of
the
path
story
that I
there.
Went,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And but over time, it became clearer and clearer to me that it wasn't just because I was drunk. I liked women.
Yep.
I liked women. But by then, I was already married to my first husband, because that's what you do.
Yeah.
And then I got a kid. I had a kid, which was not my choice. I had never wanted to have any kids. However, the kid that I got is pretty awesome. And so that's really cool. And... Then I think I did. I had a couple after that marriage ended. I did have a couple of relationships with women, but still very closeted and very. I felt like I had a lot to lose because I had this kid and I had this addiction stuff and I had lots of custody issue, like threats about. And I did lose custody of him at a certain point, not because I was a lesbian or because I got found out, but. Anyway, and so then I ended up getting married again, but I married a gay man. And at the time that I met him, I was in a relationship with a woman and we were very closeted, and then I met him and I fell in love with him and I was completely confused, like, what the hell? I thought I had this sorted out once and for all, and now here I am, you know, in love with this man again. But of course then he came out, and so then I kind of thought, okay, this is a certain kind of man that I fall in love with. Anyway, and so then when he came out, we sort of thought, we'd been planning to get married, and when he came out, we sort of broke up and thought, well, I guess we can't get married. But we realized that we really wanted to be married. We wanted to be together. Yeah. It was crazy. It sounded crazy at the time. But anyway, we decided we were going to get married, but we would have an open relationship. And so that's what we did. We got married in the Catholic Church. We had a mass. We had the whole nine yards. His kids and my kid were part of the ushers and all of that kind of jazz, and it was crazy and wild. And so anyway, so we started this life, and at that point I think I was just starting to get more aware of the politics of that this message that I'd gotten that this was not okay was not just a moral thing, that this was a political thing, that this was a not okay, and that there was stuff going on that I needed to learn about historically. And that's when I started learning about Stonewall riots and you know, and so So then when we left Winnipeg and moved here, it was 1991, and we were very committed to our open relationship and so tried really hard right at the beginning to get involved in the gay community. And it was really hard to kind of find community, right? Because although we talk about our queer community, our LGBTQ plus, et cetera, community, we are hard to find for lots of reasons that you've talked about, right?
Well, you had to hide.
Yeah. So my way in was through the Red Herring bookstore. You were talking about Granville Street. Red Herring bookstore was on Granville Street. And I discovered that bookstore, and it had a whole section, whole lesbian book section that was amazing. And I met Patrick Barnholden. Anybody remember Patrick Barnholden? Do you remember Patrick Barnholden?
I saw him 1 week ago.
Yeah, exactly. So he was volunteering at Red Herring, and I met him. And then that was kind of my ticket to meeting so many more people. And then I was feeling like, oh, my God, I have found my people. And so then, you know, I of course then was telling my husband about how I was finding my people and that he needed to go find his people. And so he did. He did do that too. And so so then in 1992, I think it was, my son, who is now 16, comes out to visit me. And I'm finally at the point where I start thinking about coming out. And it's complicated, right? I've come into women's dances and kind of I just felt like I was leading a double life because there was no way that I could tell anybody that I was married, even though I was married to a gay man. I wasn't telling. That, like, coming out is one thing, but coming out as a lesbian is married to... Anyway, it just felt so complicated. So I felt like an imposter and like I was sort of, you know, creeping people or whatever. But, man, I had fun at those women's dances. And Broad Cove was having great women's dances. Do you remember the Broad Cove dances, Anita? I would drive from where we lived in the valley, and I would drive to Broad Cove in fog, and oh my God, it was crazy. And then stay at, you know, some other random woman's house that night because it was too crazy to go home. And but anyway, Derek came to visit me, and I decided it was time to come out. And I was really scared. I just thought, what is this going to mean? Because sure, you know, his father was probably going to find out, or what would that mean? And he was amazing. Derek was amazing. And so we went to my first and his first Pride March in 1992 in Halifax. And it was small, and it was a march. It was not a parade. It was a march. And it was political. And that was really, that march in 1992 was really my politicization, I would say. I would say that was the moment that I really got politicized.
Okay.
And so Derek, I had a T-shirt that said... lesbian or lesbian mom, and Derek made one that said proud of my lesbian mom, and so we went to the Pride March together. So that was amazing. So then from then I really did start getting more politically active and making the decision to get to be out. And and you know, it was still complicated. As long as I was with Merv, it was complicated. Because he, you know, anyway, it was so the politics. And also the kind of the divide between women and men.
Yeah, big thing.
There was a bit of stuff. I think once Reflections opened, well, even Rumors. I remember going to Rumors, and there were both, but it was very segregated, as you say, you know. And it was really, I had a hard time with that because I just thought, we're all in this together. We are not each other's enemy. We need to fight together on this. And I, you know, granted, there were lots of issues that were.
But the problem is, it's like you need that focus, and the community doesn't have that focus all that much. That might be the problem with the community right now.
I think it is.
We don't have a lack of focus. The Radcliffe Center, there's another whole story. Okay, how many people remember the Radcliffe Center? That was the gay center that was started. It was up on Radcliffe, whatever, Boulevard or something.
McCara. McCara.
McCara? Okay.
Yeah. It was called Radcliffe Hall because it's a joke on a pun on a.
Right. Anyway, that went down. That was a super idea, but they didn't have anyone that really wanted to manage it. They just wanted to be in charge, and that was They had so many people that were from all different aspects of the community, but the problem was I heard that the biggest problem was the toilet backed up, and they had nobody to fix it.
Mm.
It's like,
that's quite a metaphor.
There wasn't enough lesbians on the committee. I'm telling you, it was, yeah.
It's like, all lesbians would have fixed that.
Yeah, you got that right.
Yeah, exactly. But that was another story, a sad story, that I really thought that would be, like, there's a lot of communities that have a center, but right now the only center we have is for the youth. There is nothing for us old folks. All right, there is no place for us to go. Ageism is one thing. We have so much knowledge, so many stories, so much background, but we have no place to share it. Mm. I mean, this is one beautiful day where I came out. Oh my God! I thought about this like for like 3 days before I said, "Okay, I'll come." Mm. But the problem is, I have too many stories, and I'd love to get them off my chest. I've already donated plenty to the archives. They've got my leather vest, my leather outfit. I won the, yeah, that. I was president of 3 times. Mm. That's the leather outfit that we eventually brought that down to Leather Brotherhood, and turned out to be an association of some sort. One little other guy had the name. He won it, and he won $20. So it's like, yeah, okay, that's good. And it's like, yeah, it's lived on.
But it was pretty.
But again, the problem was it had its demise in that the personalities within the club, we had lost our focus, and it was also about 10 years, and everybody had done everybody. So it's like, okay, now what do we do? We don't want to do the Bear for Kids or Toy Drives or whatever. So what else do you want to do? We still had the McCade. What was the leather thing that we had going? It wasn't Leather Pride, but it was Mac Leather. Yes, Mac Leather, which I was also president of for a few years. Had a big contest. We had like 300 leathermen come from all over the Maritimes, and we had a focus. Getting contestants, that was the problem. Getting somebody up on stage that can actually talk and have enough leather to actually wear on stage. So, yeah, well, you had to have a jock strap, and you also had to have full leather. Now, most of the people borrowed it from people their size. Nobody, well, a few of us had some nice leather, but it was like after 10 years, I got a whole closet full. Like, yeah, but I can't give it away because nobody is as tall as I am. And, you know, it's like, whoa, what am I going to do with all this?
Where did you have the shows at?
Mm-hmm.
Where did you have most of the shows? Was that
right here in Halifax. Depends on where we were. We held it in the old Legion on right across from the Commons.
Okay.
That was our biggest one. The first one, I believe, was in the Eagle, which I won. We progressed for approximately 12 years, something like that. And we had winners from New Brunswick, PEI, and we just went on and on and on. But we also went to New Brunswick and had it in one of their halls. It was like, a dream come true. And the problem is, it's like we had to earn enough money to send them to International Mr. Leather. And, of course, we didn't for the first couple of years. So we had these contests, and we put them together, and we gained the money there. We also had the Fetish Ball, which I ran for 10 years, or produced for 10 years, which was nothing more than a fundraiser for our people that are going to Chicago.
It was fun.
And the problem is, it's like we did that for 3 years, and then the guy who won it didn't want to go. Yeah, it's like surprise. It's like too big, and I'm not that type of Leatherman. And it's like he was just barely on the stage. We had to drag people onto the stage. It's like one little guy. It was like both, you know, Mike Sangster. Mike Sangster and myself just grabbed him by one arm, and Mike was on the other side, and we just carried him right out to the mic. And then held him there until he started talking. Yeah, like I said, we are not wimpy people. But this little guy had stage fright like you wouldn't believe. He was done in leather from top to bottom. He went with a doctor who could provide all this stuff. Yeah. Oh, just a skinny little guy? Oh, looked great, had a little beard going. Yeah, I'm telling you. But anyway, he was out there. We had another guy that couldn't win. He had... what's the disease where you actually get a little frightened, a little epic, and you fall asleep?
Narcolepsy.
So, Don, it turns out, remember you had earlier had a wish for someone that you could sit down for several days to and tell stories for days? We have someone right there who's being paid to do this. This is for everyone. If you have queer stories to tell, Jess is ready to record those stories.
Yeah. I wish I had a card.
Even though all these things, but actually, all these microphones.
Yeah, okay. we'll talk as you are taking the mics down. Okay. That's not a problem.
Do you remember much about the beginning of the Pride marches, Pride parades?
The Pride parades.
The first one I was in was kind of unofficial. It was candlelit memorial at Old St. George, the one that burnt down. And I was still kind of closeted at the time. I had a survival job as a security guard, but I was involved with the Gay Line and the Gay Lines of Equality. I don't think I was on the board at that point. But I had a lot to lose, and there was... jobs were scarce, so I went at night. And it was this wonderful service... lovely prayers were said and the Gregorian chants, and then we marched from St. George up to City Hall and presented some kind of a petition. And one of the surprises was there was David Stewie, who was part of the Progressive Conservative Party of Nova Scotia there. It was actually a dreamboat I had in college, but I never told him that.
Yeah.
So it was kind of weird to see him there. It was like, but. It was kind of scary. Even though it was night, we were going past Scotia Square. You know, there's people driving by. You don't know if people can see who know you. And those were not safe days.
No, my God.
You could lose your apartment. You could lose your job. Everything. I was a security guard, and they would have fired me like that. They might guess that I'm gay. But if nobody says anything and it's not an issue, it's okay. I found out when I was teaching English in Japan for 10 years. People sort of knew I was gay. But if it wasn't a scandal or an issue, they looked the other way. Mm-hmm. Living in Japan was the whole thing. I missed a lot of the AIDS crisis because from 88 to 98, I lived in Japan full-time teaching English as a second language. So yes, they had AIDS there. I don't want to get into that now. But what was your particular scene? Were you?
Yeah. No, I was just asking about the beginning of the parades.
That's the earliest one that I knew. I know there was
the only thing that I could relate to that is the brown paper bags over people's faces.
Yep. Yeah, I remember that.
What year was that? What date was that?
Yeah.
That was in that parking lot where that McDonald building is now. At the corner of Gardage and Cornwallis.
Yeah.
It was empty at the time, right? There was a church across the street, a little one. Yeah. Right? He was vocal about...
I can't remember who all...
Was
involved?
I was in college at the time, so I had nothing to do with it.
I know you guys got involved in the parade. The first couple.
Anita, do you know?
Well, I was on the sidelines
thinking. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, yeah. I can't remember who all got... I know Dan had the bikes the first couple of years there, and then... the Dykes on Bikes came second or third year.
Yep.
And
my partner and I rode our bikes in one parade one year.
Oh, yeah. What year was that?
Yep.
What year would that have been? Maybe 98?
So you had been here for a few years before you decided to get involved.
But that first parade, I do remember that, the first march, there were people who were definitely masked, if not wearing paper bags. But I can remember people driving down the street, like, looking straight ahead, and I was just like, oh, I can't look at them because I might catch it. I remember thinking that, right? Oh, yes.
Nancy, were you in the parade, or were you watching it?
No, we were, no, always in. Always in.
Oh, awesome.
Absolutely.
Were you with a group?
Nope, just on our own.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, just on my own, yeah. There were no groups in those early days.
Right.
We just marched as individuals. We marched, So there were no groups. The whole group thing came much later with more corporatization and...
Yeah,
more of the parades.
Who's organizing the girls' dances?
Oh, God, there were a bunch of people who were organizing the women's dances. And there were women's dances. Well, so there was a choir. There's an a cappella choir called the Women Next Door, who I sang with for quite a few years. Yeah. They're still around. They just celebrated their 31st anniversary and on Monday night, and their 31st birthday. And we organized a shit ton of women's dances, partly for fundraising, because we were political. We wanted to support Take Back the Night and IWD, and we sang at AIDS vigils, and and all of the repertoire was political for the most part. And so we were doing these women's dances, which were they were such a lot of work, but they were so fun and they were so needed, because there wasn't an organized women's community at that time. So women just
The women's bar didn't come into it for 20 years.
Right.
Something like that.
Exactly, yeah.
It wasn't until the gay bars were out there, and then all of a sudden, whoa, a lesbian bar.
Mm-hmm.
But it's right there in the community, and it's well protected, and it's like, okay, that's right there on Godigan Street. But I remember a few church halls and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I used to do the Atlantica.
That was.
I almost got invited.
That was Brenda. Brenda Barnes. No, Brenda. Who ran? Oh man, I can't remember her name. Now. Yeah. Anyway, she's left. She left when at Halifax. But anyway,
So Ben, we're going to wrap up in about 10 minutes, and then do our break, and then reset our table. Do you have a lighthearted question to kick around the table for our last question for this session?
Okay.
Lighthearted question.
Lighthearted question.
Some funny times.
Yeah. Did you ever run into somebody who you may or may not have thought was gay at a bar, and they didn't know that you were? That happened to me. I nearly had a heart attack. But how about you? Was there a time when you ran into somebody at a bar, and it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah, I've had a few of those.
Sounds like Nancy has a story.
Yeah.
I remember that, too, and saying, what are you doing here? And they said, well, what are you doing here? And then, so at first it felt very threatening, and then I realized, oh, my God, we both have everything to lose here. And it's, so then it was okay, right? So then we were allies, and it became an okay thing. But
the Rumors Bar on Gardison Street, that, although, you guys said, look, it was a big place.
It was huge.
Everybody's here and there. But you could avoid somebody, no problem.
Yeah, you could.
You could, and you could also just go stand somewhere and wait for somebody to come around the corner, so you could say, what are you doing now?
Yeah.
That bar was kind of unique because it was no theater, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I got it.
How were New Year's Eve parties and stuff like that?
Oh, the New Year's Eve parties were fantastic. And the lineups for the payphone to call your folks was incredible. It was a huge lineup. Hi, Mom and Dad, I'm at the gay bar for my first gay New Year's. Happy New Year, son. People are just crying, it's so lovely. And the guys are in their tuxes, who could get one from rented shops or from secondhand stores.
Phoning their parents?
I did,
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the problem with gay people. They're so emotional.
That's what
only
I like
you
about
gay men.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's only the gay guys that, get to cry and tear and hug and.
I think that's something to be proud of, because it's unhealthy not to cry.
Absolutely.
To go around with a an emotional broomstick up your butt because you're afraid you'll lose your stiff upper lip and somebody will think you're a wimp is wimpy.
Yeah. Well, what would you think could, like, back in those days with rumors and reflections and that, I mean, we're going back 20
years,
right? And you had said something about there's no place anymore.
Yeah.
What sort of venue would be a good spot that older folk could get together early evening, because we all crash.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Early evening.
2 days.
Well, something like this, but we've got a group called the Elderberries. We have get-togethers, and we talk about different things. Actually, it could be gardening or end-of-life issues, or it could be walking the Camino in northern Spain. One woman gave a presentation on polar bear research. Another time, two lesbian authors gave reviews of their books and how they wrote books and the problems they had being accepted as a lesbian writer. And the room was packed with women. In other words, other times you just hear crickets, you know? It's like it's very up and down.
Gay crickets.
Gay crickets, yes. They did it with show tunes. Yeah. But what I loved, I think one of the binding things we had in 70s, 80s, is the guys physically hugged each other a lot. It was very, very common. We're like Italians, and that's something that Nova Scotians did not do. Mm-hmm. And this is why I loved living in Quebec, because Quebec was a much more expressive live and live culture. I wanted to stay there, but it didn't work out. But I just wonder, is it just as much hugging now? I don't think there is. I think it should start. I think people don't realize how important physical touch is.
It stopped a few years ago.
Yeah, it's like it's not cool or it's in... Well, yeah, I know. You can't just go hug strangers.
Well, the problem is it depends on which society you're in.
Yeah.
Like, if you are a bear, you're definitely going to hug. It's like, it doesn't matter. You're big. You're furry. It's like, you know, what else are you going to do? You're going to hug. Gay, straight guys... The court, no. That is, like, probably a no-no. Curtsy, yeah. I've done that on occasion. You know, the empress is like, what are you supposed to do? It's like, yeah, right.
One of the big things in Halifax is the Halifax Gay Men's Chorus. I was there from the beginning. And we have smashing goodbye parties like you wouldn't believe. Because there's at least one hairdresser who has an elegant salon with crystal chandeliers and bubbling champagne fountains and girls in violet sequins nightgowns giving you flutes of champagne. And you don't get that at the local barbecue. But that's when it's goodbye time, the hugs come out. People hug. And I think that's great. And it's important. It's not a plus.
Are there a lot of shows with the chorus?
There's one Christmas. There's one in the summer fall.
Okay.
We sang at Pride often. We marched in Pride. We were supposed to give two shows free at the waterfront, but we got rained out by the torrential floods.
Yeah. So, speaking of Queer Community Center, there's actually plans to build one.
Mm.
That requires community input. It won't happen unless people show up on October 24th to a conference. There's a conference to design the Queer Community Center. So, if you don't know about the details of that, send me a note, or just Google up Halifax Community Center. It's a Waves article from a couple of weeks ago. So, if you want to make a community center happen, you can be part of it.
Or
if no one shows up to say we want a community center, guess what's going to happen?
Nothing.
So there's that. We should wrap up.
Yeah.
Just a second. Are donations accepted towards that center?
I think it's all going to be paid for by a certain church.
Very nice.
By who church?
By St. Mark's Anglican.
Really?
Not St. Mark's, no. St. Andrews.
Oh, wow.
St. Andrews is tearing down their campus and rebuilding a new thing, and they have a very active minister there named Sean Friday, who said, guys, you don't get to say that you're an affirming church without putting your money where your mouth is, right. And so if you're rebuilding the campus, you're going to rebuild it with a queer community center.
Wow,
sweet.
That's amazing. Sweet. What time is that meeting, Dan?
What's that?
What time is the meeting?
Either the whole building or their the back building.
The back building.
Yeah. Yep. Either.
What time is that meeting?
It's all day. It's on a Saturday.
All day.
Yeah. So send me a note, and I'll send you the link to the Waves article, or just go to waves.ca and look for the article.
About what's the address, Daniel?
The address is St. Andrew's United Church.
St. Andrews, that's
at Coburg and Robey.
Oh, Coburg and Robey, okay.
Yeah.
Across from the bank.
Where you guys perform.
This is where we practice. That's where we have our Christmas concert.
That's great. Okay, guys.
Hey, let's break.
We're going to take a break.
Thank you,
speakers. We're going to have some mix and match of a new set of speakers coming up in about 5 minutes. So have a bio break, grab some food, grab a wiener.
That's a telling phrase.
And, come back in 5.
Story about, I don't know, problems with their parents coming out to them. Someone else said, well, that reminds me of a story, but it may not even be about coming out to parents. It could be something else. It's just that there's another element that they hooked in and said, oh, that reminds me of my auntie who was quite the diesel dyke and a motorbikist. You know, I haven't actually a lesbian auntie who was a motorcycle lesbian.
Lucky
in the
you.
1930s and 40s. So queerness runs in my family. But anyway, my name is Baron Camperman, and this is... Let's just introduce ourselves quickly, and then I'll throw out one question. How about Mike here?
G'way, my name is Miguel. That is Big Ma for Michael.
Okay.
Oh, Anita Martinez.
Tell us about yourself a bit.
Oh, Lord, have mercy.
I know you're a boring suburban housewife.
Are you a lesbian? are you a member of the LGBTQ plus
That's
community?
That's great. I love everybody. So what are you going to do? Where do you start? I was born in 1939, 11 o'clock Saturday night. And I'm glad I'm here.
I'm Nancy McKinnell.
Richard Crooks. Hey.
Oh, I know you.
Kev.
I don't recognize you.
Oh, we'll talk after. I do.
What's your name?
Nancy McKinnell.
Nancy.
McKinnell.
We'll talk after.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah, great. Okay, where's my glasses? Shoot. Pardon me?
Loaning you my
glasses. Oh, no,
glasses. Oh, glasses.
Thank you, anyway. I'd like to start off with something. Do you remember an embarrassing incident with a good friend of yours?
Yes.
Anyway, these are our speakers. It could be any kind of a situation, but that was like a little bit embarrassing.
Ooh. I do have an embarrassing, yes.
No.
I do. This was a younger, like in my 14, 15, and I, my very, very, very good friend Lorraine, we would have sleepovers. They were all very innocent sleepovers. They were just, you know, girls sleeping over. And I was already recognizing that there were parts of girls' bodies that I liked. And I found myself occasionally, after they were asleep, accidentally on purpose, stretching such that I could touch their breasts. And I did that fairly regularly without getting caught, but I got caught. I got caught one night. That was very embarrassing. I had to really fake it, but yeah, that was very embarrassing. But it was still fun. Any embarrassing moments?
Not really, but since I'm a team, I can't get to PG.
Oh, wow. Mine probably wasn't either, but...
Richard, I know there was a time that there was a presentation at your school or high school that was pivotal in your life.
Yes, we've known each other a long time now.
So I'm in West Ings High. I grew up in the valley. If you know where the Napa's Valley is, Fort Tim and Greenwood, the big air base down there. But West Ings is about 20 minutes back this way up the highway in a place called Elsford. And so there was... she just passed away.
JJ?
No, the woman.
Jean Kansas.
Yeah, Kansas,
oh,
yes.
Yes.
And her partner from Dow. I was a horrible with names. I'll always remember their faces. So we're talking grade nine or grade ten. So we every year they had this big health week. So near the end of the week, it was always the guest speakers would come in and do things. So we had a lady from the Red Door in the Valley, who was actually the nurse who brought me to the world, and so she always brought this teaching how to put a condom. But we're talking a very group. I graduated in 94, so grade 10 was like, what, 92? This glass penis, you think she'd come in, and Phyllis Sweet was her name. And she'd show you how to put the condom, this glass thing, and she'd have all these, you know, sexual protection things like diaphragm. They had the oral dam thing, or what it was called.
Dental dam,
that was just coming out then. So that was one of these. And then that afternoon, Jane Kansas and her partner had their time. So we're sitting in a classroom of about 35, 40 people. So some of us, we sort of knew who was and who wasn't, okay, at that point, even way back in those days. And so they came up to us and literally one by one said, hi, gave me your name, and I'm a lesbian. Every one in the room. And four of us kind of reacted. She got a grin. And so I think the magazine was called Gala at this point in time, I think it was.
Yes.
Waves hadn't come into it yet. So we had those, were there. There was a whole, any question you wanted, she was there to answer, Phyllis was there to answer. And then, sort of at the end of all of that, the end of the day, I started talking to her. I said, well, yeah, I saw you flinch. I knew why you reacted. And the other two girls, those two were lesbians. And and then it never really hit me how important that was to me until I read it to Jane at Fringe Festival. I've been doing the Fringe for years. In front of house stuff, and she was there after her first show. She came into the bar up at the bus stop, and I started getting a little emotional. I said, can I speak to you? She said, are you talking to me, kind of thing. And then she clued in who I was, and we both started crying and hugging. It was like, at this point, I sort of knew I was gay, but until somebody actually sort of said, yeah, I clued, take that little, you know, I'm like, you actually helped me come out of the closet. I was like, you know, we're talking, this is the valley in the 90s. The Bible Belt. I mean, Greenwood was, when I was in high school, outside of the French, everybody was English and white. And there was literally one other family there. There was nobody else. It was like very farmy, rural, in the military town aspect. So you had the two of them together, and that's all there really was. No one really talked about much. But now, Greenwood now has, there's the Valley Prides there. You've got the bar at the back of the mall now doing drag shows. They have a gay group at West Kings, I think, now. The teachers that are gay have come out at West Kings. We're talking 30 years since those days. But it's just amazing what that one week. A lot of teachers were just getting to West Kings around this time. So those teachers have stayed with the school for the entire growth of itself. And yeah, it was just a powerful thing, a little emotional, but I know the camera's on, so I won't let myself cry at this point. But yeah, it was just a very powerful time realizing that, yeah. Yeah, never forget it.
Hmm. Miguel, do you feel really connected to the Metro Gay GBLTQ community?
I have probably done more in this community than a lot of people have.
Mm-hmm.
My disconnect is you don't remember me. You don't know who I am. And it's a color blindness that you have in the queer community.
Yeah.
I was going to say something much different, but part of today has actually shown me that.
Yeah.
I have been on every chair of every queer thing we have had in Halifax, except for the Elderberries. I have chaired, co-chaired Pride, only to hear that Dark Color started with Morgan. That's not true. And in fact, if you know the correct history, which we all should be getting out more, is the fact that when that first parade happened, it was put together by a group of women, the women's group, GLAAD, and there were two black women that were on the chair of that at the time. We don't talk about that enough. We have rewritten our own history to include predominantly white gay men in places of power. So we do the same thing that is hegemonic. We perpetrate it within the queer community. Mm-hmm. But because we are an oppressed community, we don't notice it. Mm. We don't think that we are oppressors of the oppressed.
Right.
And we are. So things have happened within the community. You ask, why are there not more people of color out within the queer community? It's because we leave. We don't stay where we're not wanted.
Yeah.
You talk about these spaces that you've been in, and I've been put out of those spaces. And, I mean, it's a double thing because I'm also female-bodied, but I look male. And so I've been put out of women's dances because they're like, oh, you want to be a man. Been put out of male spaces because I don't have the male parts. And that is just my life. I've learned to negotiate it very well. I don't let people put me out of spaces anymore. And I speak up when things like this happen. And so the disconnect within our community, talked earlier, I have a few notes here, on Gottingen Street, and you talk about, you know, the gay villa and how, I think there was one word used like sleazy, and it was an area. That's my home.
Mm-hmm.
You folks came there. So I'm going to separate myself from the queer community because that's what happens. That was a black and indigenous place of being long before it became a place of queerness. It became a place of queerness because as what happens in most small areas, tend to group together. And it was a space where you did feel welcome because there were other people there that were within the minority groups with you. And there was an allowance for that. But then somewhere along the way, that got forgotten, and it just became a gayborhood. And so the people that were there that, like, said, come to our, like, this is our area, we're sharing it with you, suddenly did not belong to that area anymore. Mm. So that's how displacement happens in things like that, where crime and things get blamed on one thing, and then it gets said it's getting cleared up, and it's not cleared up. It just gets moved around. It gets re-reported differently. So the disconnect, I feel very connected in the things that I've done.
Yeah.
With NS Rap, NS Perk, and Pride. What else, Dan? Check Wade. Dan's wiki.
Wade.
Yeah. What?
Wade.
Yeah, Mike has a page in the encyclopedia, so just Google that up.
I am the advocate that won trans women's rights for breast surgery. I have done a lot within the community, and I come to events like this all the time and have people ask me how I'm connected. And that just shows that right there, queer community needs to stop. And I use the word queer. That's my word. I capture it. I know some don't accept it. And I understand that it does come with trauma, so I do apologize for that. But that's the only way I can encompass. I can't use the alphabet. I'm dyslexic. I get confused. So when I say that the disconnect and how people have to accept it is to recognize where there are oppressive moments within the oppressed. When you cannot sit down and think of the two women in GLAAD that helped do that paper bag march, the queer black woman, because I started Pride as a woman, who did stuff. I was there with Raymond. I've heard conversations about times in my life that I was there where I'm literally taken out of it. So that's what, so I don't feel disconnected. To me, leaving the brick in the room is your folks' disconnection to the reality of your own history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you. That was
thank
important.
You.
We're all in yeah.
Wait.
Yeah.
Thank you.
What do you think is good in the queer community now that is connective, that creates the possibility of bonds or new beginnings or new friendships or new groups besides today? I found that small groups work, and well, you think all small groups, what's that going to get you? Well, a group is a group, and actually the smaller the group is, the more intimate it is. Dan knows one of us, queers with dogs, or gay men with dogs, for example, you know.
One of the wackiest new groups is people who have dogs and want to share them with people who don't have dogs. They meet on the third Sunday of every month on the Commons, and so it's just it's not an exercise thing. You don't walk anywhere. You get there, you plop down on the blanket, and people play with your dog. It's pretty awesome.
I would like to say something on a more positive note.
Yeah.
Earlier you talked about spaces for older people, you know, LGBT people and trans, that would, you know, make them feel welcome. But I also think there needs to be some more mediation groups. There needs to be some more connection between queer and youth, like older queer and youth.
Yes.
I just finished being on the International Trans Committee that did North America, and I was a queer elder on that. And one of the things that came out of that was really fantastic was the connection between younger and older, and allowing for there to be a space in the middle, and having stories and information given from the older people that had already done some of that, and also then sharing stories from the younger people that were trying to go through some of that stuff, but maybe in different situations. Because the world is changing, so there are situations that even older queer people would not have been aware of, mm-hmm. or had to face, mm-hmm. or they face differently.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of that, we did, I know NSRAP did a meeting with, and I think there was Elderberries involved with that, with kind of a peer group, and we were paired with a youth or a younger person. And I took part in that. Which, again, was problematic because I was not part of the Elderberries, but I got called in on that because they couldn't find someone to pair with the young adult who was Black and Indigenous.
Oh, man.
Because there was none in the Elderberries.
Mm. Was that the event at Central Library a few years back?
No, we actually did it at... they showed it at the library.
Yeah.
But we filmed it at on Dell. But, yeah, it was shown at the library, yes. And so that kind of thing. And so I think there to make more connection, first of all... It helps youth get more grounded and gives them more information about what has happened. And it keeps the older group more aware of what's ongoing, and mm-hmm. gives, and you can find places where, hey, you know what? I can help you with that.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives you something more to keep going within the community.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to end up sitting in two different camps thinking that you don't need to talk. So I think that that's a really good way of moving forward.
Yeah, and there's a reciprocity in that process as well. Mm. It's not just the elders sharing information. It's an osmosis thing. It's a giving back and forth. They're our descendants. We're ultimately going to be their ancestors, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Building on that, a couple of things. The Elderberries has a group called the Speakers Bureau, and in the school system is something called the GSA, which is now called the Gender Sexual Alliance, which used to be the Gay Straight Alliance. And we have given presentations at junior highs and high schools, and sometimes they have big plenary sessions where all the groups from all over Nova Scotia come and meet at Dell, and there's thousands of them, and they ask us, they give a little presentation, and Q&As. Q&As, I love Q&As, because... it's random, and everybody gets a turn. But did you hear about this? You know about Lend a Book. In libraries in Scandinavia, they have Lend a Person. You can book a time with, say, a Buddhist monk or a retired nun or a retired lesbian activist or a Black radical person of color who is now an old veteran.
who's retired, and they can you know what their specialty is, what they like to talk about. You can sit down and have a one-on-one with them. You book it. I know there must be certain rules about that, and you can't just willy-nilly like go to a coffee shop, but I mean, I think that's something to think about.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think in the teaching of my people, the indigenous part, I think a lot of like what you're saying there is actually like our elders.
Yeah.
And we have elders and residents at Dalhousie. So there is much to say about having like queer elders and reaching out to see if that can be something put in place. I would say, you know, you don't have to redo the wheel. Look around and see how other people are doing it.
Yeah.
The indigenous people have been doing it for ten thousands of years. Mm-hmm. So look at that and look how it's done, not to take away from it and claim it as your own, mm-hmm. but to say, hey, this is a system that works.
Yeah.
What can we do that would be along the lines of that, that could help queer youth? Mm.
Right.
Excellent. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
So, anybody on the panel, have you had a time where a younger person came to you and asked you for some specific advice?
Oi.
Oi, she says.
I don't know where I would start with that one, because it happens a lot. I've got 6 children, okay, to start with. Mm. So I was married a few times. I tried. You know what I mean? I tried.
She's
I never got it right, but I got 6 kids. And the race barrier is part of it. So, ask that question one more time.
Okay. did you help anybody in their coming out process or realization process?
Well, my daughter.
Oh.
Well, I have one.
Tell them, not me.
It's hard. I'll tell you what. I'm a photographer. I mean, not professionally, but I'm insane. I won a camera when I was 8 years old, and I haven't stopped taking pictures of everything and anything, and it doesn't matter if it's a caterpillar or a cloud. Just like that. So when somebody asks me a question, it's like if I had a camera in my hand, I'd be able to answer that question. So I'm really sorry. I've got lots to say. Ask me questions.
Can I tell an Anita story then?
Okay. Yes, please.
When we did the very first Dyke and Trans merch.
I got pictures.
So we're going up the road, and they've got one side blocked off because there was a big kerfuffle on that about they didn't want to alert the police. I did, but I have a very good relationship with the police and did it in a way of, hey, we're not asking for permission. I'm telling you this is going to happen during rush hours so that we won't get bogged down. But so they blocked up one side. So the other side was supposed to be for traffic, but they didn't take an account, nor did I, Anita. So here's Anita driving up the wrong side of the road and blocking up traffic to jump out and take those pictures every so often. And we're saying, Anita, they're going to arrest you. And she said, I'm a grandmother. They're not going to touch me. Right? And she gets back in her car and off she goes.
You use what you can.
And in giving information and advice to people, that's kind of basically been your go-to. Like the grandmother thing of like, hey, this is just you. Just take the world on as you can.
Yeah, you are so right.
I've got to say, I have been the most fortunate. I had a terrible childhood, only with my mother and father. But the neighbors were amazing. And one Chinese family in a place called the Red Dragon, in right across from Buffalo, New York, they took me in and they taught me Chinese. They taught me the everything, and I sat at their table for years. And today, one of the daughters calls me sis. Mm. I have been, and the neighbors, and they all knew that what was happening in my home. My dad was Hitler. He loved Hitler, and he played Hitler. And I was the first child after a boy was born, and he despised me. But the neighbors loved me. And I was I've got to be the most fortunate human being. And to see all you people and to hear, I feel so honored. You have no idea how totally honored I am to be sitting here. That's it.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, hi, me. That's I love you in Mandarin.
Aww.
I'm Lady Janet Chen's in Alderney Gate.
Yeah.
She's taught me a lot of Mandarin.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Thank you.
What do you see as your own personal participation in the future of the queer community? You're part of it.
Richie, what would you say?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm kind of that middle, 48 in a couple of weeks. I'm sort of the middle ground between I'm not the young and I'm not in my 50s yet, or I would be around the same time everything was happening in the city. So it's kind of been... I don't know if I'm carrying even the flag. I think I've kind of sort of passed that part of it, really, but I know I've done a lot of advocacy, and I kind of was one of those weird people. And that he's probably where the waterworks might kick in. My parents were not at all churchy people, but in the rural area where we lived, the churches were the babysitters. It was a youth group every Friday night. I was an only kid. Mom's like, oh, there you go, free babysitting. They came around and pick us up. So I became very close to the Baptist church in my hometown. When I was process coming out, the minister realized I was more than just friends with his son. The son was sent to Barry with his uncle, who was also a pastor, and I was more or less told, there's the door, whether you leave on your own or we'll kick you out. This is a church I'd lived through all my, been through all my life. The people were like family to me. Okay, the three people at the church who were my family, when they heard this, they're like, we're gone. they were all sort of, one was gay, two of them were lesbian, but never, back in those days, though, they never talked about it, though. It's like, sort of a generation, well, they're in their late 70s, or early, well, going past them, but late 70s, early 80s, so they're sort of in that, they never talked about it, but we all knew, it was never really discussed. So they went through that, happened, they all left. So it took me, oddly enough, when I that happened, I was in Middleton one day. And Middleton, for years, I can't even remember, we're Valley Pride, you said, it was more Middleton area. And the Holy Trinity Anglican Church had a minister there, Eric McDonald. I went up there one day for something, and he said, talk. He's like, big deal, you're gay. Who cares? God loves you. Moving on. You know? He had, like, come in. So I ended up being an Anglican for a number of years. And he was actually one of the ones who spearheaded, after his wife passed away, the whole doctor-assisted suicide helping in Canada. But anyway, so moving along to the present day, I wound up, I don't know if it was too easy to look at people, but the ironic thing about it is a church here in Halifax was fairly conservative for years, West End Baptist. At the point, I think, in the 90s, they even fired their organist for being gay. This church is now run by a young Russian family. Yeah, he's Russian, she's Ukrainian. They're 40 lovely people. And I wound up getting Google would say, oh, come to this thing. It was like a book space. I wound up going in there. I mean, I'm the gay boy. This will last about 10 minutes in this church. Instantaneously clicked with, I knew four of the people of the valley. And the next day, he said, let's go for coffee. I told him my whole story. He couldn't believe it. 3 weeks later, he says to me, we're going to go to Greenwood. The minister now passed away. There would be hundreds if they're still alive. Him and his wife died. And I could never, even though I'm in my 40s, I took the longest while to get over that. Mm. Because these are people that you looked up to.
Yeah.
And it took going to that church, rightly enough. We're going to go to Greenwood. Write down what you would have said to them and read it to them when you get there. I had two packed bags in his pocket. Boom, boom. That's what Greer said. I read it to them. Hardest thing with the best you could ever do. Forgive them? Probably, I guess I sort of did. It's still always, obviously, an emotional thing. But it's just kind of funny. The church that had been through that and in their past, I was kind of like, we don't give a rat's ass. That was going to be a reason for me, you know, like, thanks, as First Baptist is. But they're at a stage where they're moving along. It's kind of a funny thing. They actually are sending me into all things with my rainbows and all. Don't change a thing. To Crandall for the Baptist Church Conference coming up in 2 weeks' time. So I'll literally be the first openly gay guy from a Baptist church going to the most conservative university in Atlanta, Canada, and told them, just be yourself. If they ask you, it could be newsworthy. I don't know, but it'll be interesting just to say that. Yeah, I kind of cringe with the, oh, it's at Crandall. Last 2 years it was in Acadia, so perfectly fine to do Acadia. I grew up in Acadia. But yeah, so it's an interesting full circle. That, yeah. Now it's like, yeah, the church that threw you up because you were, yeah, the church that was guilty of the same sin later on in the 90s is now saying, you're gone, good job. I'm still scared I'm going to be going to Crandall, but that's beside the point. Everything else happening. But yeah, sorry about getting the teary eye.
What was the question?
Well, a key person that gave you a breakthrough up in life or helps you to deal with something, or someone came to you and you helped them up.
And I'm not sure there is, I mean, I found people along the way, but I came out as the first trans here, so there was really nobody to give me a big breakthrough because nobody knew what it was. But a lot of people have come to me, and I think the one I remember the most is the person that years after they came out, we were at a function, they came up to me and they said, you probably don't remember the first time I saw you, or that we saw each other, and I said, no, because I was hiding behind a tree. And she said, it was at Pride, and you stood on stage, and you talked about being trans. Because at the time I didn't use Two-Spirit because nobody talked about that then. And you talked about how it was still in the DSM-3 and 4 is listed as a mental health condition. And she said, I wanted to come out so badly, but I was so afraid I hid behind a tree so no one would see me. And she said, that day that I listened to you, I came out from behind the tree. Right. That's always tough.
I don't know if you've heard this complaint or observation, and I don't think it's just applying to queer people. I think it's a generational thing, is that texting and pickup cultures just through apps is destroying connectivity.
Absolutely.
In the culture, is making a hollow shell out of friendships, is kidding people that they have a relationship with the latest bunch of texts they got from someone who doesn't give a brat's ass about them and can't remember who they are or wouldn't stick up for them or invite them to a party, or if they did, it was just to fill a chair. I know that's kind of a grim way to put it. I'm sure a lot of good things. I love texting. You know, I wish more people my age would text. I don't know what's the big deal about it. But anyway, I see that. I think that's why we can't get bars going. And do you think this... is it all about connectivity?
I think the main thing you have to look at first is actually understanding the generational shift in language.
Yeah.
Because texting and how you connect online and connect with your phone is different now. So it's not so much that it's destroying, because actually the things that you just talked about about whether or not is causing people not to connect more, was identified by the younger group as well. So they've kind of, there's kind of a move towards how pickups are done or how meetings are done, and there's a shift, especially for safety of women,
yeah,
on how things. So you have to take away the older mind thought and theory on how these started and sit down and like look at how they've evolved and what they're doing now. Mm. There is, I do agree that there's still damage to people connecting one-on-one and talking, but there's actually spaces made for that, even though you may see a younger generation like on their phone 24/7, but there's actually now when you're talking about the me time and the health time, and that's them then going then and connecting with one another. Mm. And stuff like that. That's stepping away. They may have the phone still in their hand, but it's still stepping away. It's a new way of doing it that takes it back to having a connection with somebody else other than just a phone or a computer.
Mm. What do you think, Nancy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting... I think it kind of goes back a little bit to what you were saying earlier, too, about creating forums where youth and elders, if you want to, you know, make that division, can have more conversation.
Yeah.
That is reciprocal, or that is where they're actually forming community. And I kind of feel like it might have to start in person first.
And I would say that it would. First of all, younger generation would probably joke that the older generation couldn't follow them online fast enough.
Right, it's true.
Nobody wants to wait till your grandmother texts you one line,
right,
or figure out what you just texted them. But there's a lot of those spaces being opened up, and I see it within other cultures. There's a lot of spaces to like a lot of within different color cultures. Our older generations are always there in our spaces.
Exactly.
So it's kind of, sometimes I find it a little weird to navigate conversations about that because I'm like, we do that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's a disconnect within some, not every culture does, but it's a disconnect within some.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think that you would find that if you started those spaces that you could have those conversations together. I'm very lucky. I go to Dalhousie. I'm with a multi-generational thing. I work for AIDS Coalition Nova Scotia, which encompasses three separate generations. And literally, it's kind of my thing right now. I'm working on equity inclusion for the coalition. So I look at how this works together.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. You have to have those conversations first because without that, you wouldn't know that, yes, you identify the problem. Like, I still think of my dad saying to my kid, oh, come out of that phone. You're always on that phone. You're always on that phone. How do you know what's going on? And I'm thinking she knows exactly what's going on. But her way of doing it is different than your way of doing it. That she doesn't have to put down the phone to have that connection whenever.
Mm-hmm.
Then I've also seen two people sit together on the bus and talk on the cell.
Right.
And I do it. You were looking at me. I know. I do it only because I have damaged hearing and I can't hear when I'm out in public. So it's easier for me to have that conversation that way.
Mm-hmm.
So there are different reasons why and there's different ways to navigate that.
Mm-hmm.
But this generation won't know how that generation's working with it, or the generation in between, because there's a billion little generations now, won't know how they're doing it unless they have those conversations.
Right.
Instead, you're just going to sit there going, put the cell phone down.
Right.
You're not, you're like, you're being rude. Nobody, you're not talking to anybody. You're not connecting.
Right.
And they're thinking, wow, you're so old. Why don't you know I'm really connecting?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes pictures. It takes pictures. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
One thing, a topic I see coming up a lot in forums like Gay Men's Brotherhood and Gay Men Going Deeper is apps like, say, Grindr or Tinder. The beauty standards are ludicrous. They are insanely stupid. A lot of airbrushed. Well, in case of males, I can't speak of females. Like, you have to be buff. Your abs have to be prominent. You don't have abs, you don't exist. I'm a exaggerating, of course, but
not by much.
A lot of people. Do you think that? But we've always had a beauty culture. Like the good-looking guys, you know, they are beating people away. Like, get away. They could, I've known a guy, good-looking guys, that can get free drinks all night. But do you think it's gone off the tracks, or it's just a sideline issue? And what about women's beauty standards? Are they more realistic now?
Of course.
Those issues have always been there.
Yeah, yeah, these are not old issues.
Yeah, when I was young, I modeled as a female. Mm-hmm. And I was the person who got drinks bought all night. And it was lovely because I was like little teeny tiny and long hair, and it was wonderful. But beauty standards have never been realistic to begin with. Ever.
Never.
And if you believe that picture that somebody just showed you on Grindr, I have a bridge. I'm selling it.
Look at Diesel. Right. Busting the body image.
Yeah, and so the thing is, a lot of times, though, too, if push comes to shove, when you start backing away from those people with the beautiful pictures, they suddenly start becoming more realistic.
Right.
They'll come out behind the picture, because at the end of the day, they don't want to be left alone.
Right, right.
There's a lot of, because I think a lot of people just do the, oh, stop and walk away. But if you actually delve a little bit in there, human psyche, it's like we do not like rejection. That's it, period.
Yeah.
No matter what our picture looks like and what lie we're trying to put out there.
Yeah, that's true.
We don't like criticism, a lot of people.
That's right. And the thing is, and I'm going to tell you from the other side of the pool, being part of the beautiful people was not pretty. I was much happy when I walked away from that world because it was really dirty and nasty.
Okay. I think it's time for our break now.
Okay, welcome back to session three, and a little more intimate this time.
Oh.
What we're going to start with is your coming out story.
Oh my God.
And we don't have 3 hours, so
yeah.
Give us juicy excerpts.
And we should be out of here around, right around 5 o'clock.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. That's 34 minutes. And so as we say...
Well, so I think most people were here for the beginning part of my, when I did sort of talk about my coming out story. But I just to recap, I definitely kind of was going on the straight trajectory until I fell in love with a girl when I was 14, and then that all went to hell in a handbasket, and I got the message loud and clear that that wasn't acceptable, and so then I decided I better do the boys, and but there were intermittent girls, or girls intermittently, and what I realized in time when I on reflection was the number of girls increased or women increased and the number of men decreased as time went on. So eventually I figured out that it was really women that I was after. Despite that, I got married twice. I had a kid with my first husband and I was with a woman when I met my second husband. But I gave her up for him. And because I was in love with him and I thought I wanted to be with him. Well, I did want to be with him. But it was very, very tortured. It was a very tortured time. But anyway, a year later, he came out. And I was really, really pissed. Because I gave up a lot to be with him. And he came out. And I was devastated. Because I was like, I turned my life upside down. And I really thought, when I was with this woman, I really thought that that was it. And then I fell in love with him. And that kind of, you know, it didn't go the way that I thought it was going to go. But anyway, so when he came out... We decided that we would have an open, we would stay together, have an open relationship. It was sort of before polyamory became a thing, and so that's how we navigated. And I was reflecting on that this morning, and I remember right around the time that we got married, we felt very weird. We felt like we felt very closeted because we didn't belong in either side, right? We couldn't really be out because we were married, and we couldn't be straight because we weren't, you know. And so it was really awkward. Difficult place to be, and so we had each other, thank goodness, and our various love interests. Yes,
I've heard the story twice, and I'm still confused about. I don't understand whether you knew you were a lesbian, and he knew he was a gay man, and you decided that getting married was an okay thing anyway.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
okay.
That's what. Well, because we wanted to be together, so we couldn't figure out another alternative. So yes, we were very clear. I was lesbian, he was gay, and we were going to be together.
All right.
So yeah, that's kind of how that went. So, so where was I there?
Your marriages.
Right. I just lost
so then he came out, and then you decided you might as well come out too.
Well, no, I was already out. Oh, I had already been out then because I was with a woman when I met him. But I fell in love with him. So we got together, and I gave up this woman. Her name was Ronnie, and I gave her up. And then a year later, we were together. He and I were together planning to get married, and he came out. Mm. So then we decided, yes, we'd still be together, but we would have an open relationship. So we did that. Mm. And the exciting thing that happened in that whole identity thing is that we discovered the book called Portrait of a Marriage, which was the story of Vita Sackville West and Harold Nicholson from the Virginia Woolf days, where having open marriages was a thing. And so Vita had lots of women, lots of relationships with women, and Harold had lots of relationships with men, and it was a thing that was happening. And we were over the moon to discover this book because we felt like we weren't so odd after all. And so then we did start sort of, you know, branching out and talking to other people. But it was very difficult to
little question. Did you actually bring your girls home?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, there was two people that we had, the three of us were in a relationship for a while.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, for him, what I figured out is that he really loved intimacy with women, not sexual intimacy, but intimacy with them, but he loved sex with men. So ultimately, he didn't pursue a relationship as a gay man. And I don't know how he identifies these days. I mean, I still love him to bits. We still have very good friendship.
Wonderful.
Okay. And he married another lesbian.
That'll show you.
How about you, Don?
Me? Coming up, let's see. It was after I finished university at Maine. I had like umpteen little affairs. I've been playing with guys since I was 14. Also dating girls for 6 weeks at a time. After 6 weeks, it was like, nope, need a new one. I didn't know why. It's like, that's just the cycle.
Yeah.
And then I got into the gay community, and it's like, oh my God, yes, I'll do the same thing. Right. They did not appreciate that at all. Guys do not appreciate a 6 week and gone kind of guy, let alone, okay, overnight's not a problem. But by 6 weeks, they're getting serious.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, I was turning them over, because I sort of came out seriously. I went to Rumors. The Turret. Yeah. And I walked past that place 4 times, back and forth. I knew where it was. I had checked it out. But walking back and forth, back and forth. And then I said, screw this. All right, in you go. That was it.
Mm.
Yeah, I met my present husband at the one on Granville Street. He was down there, he was dancing away. I was dancing away. And bingo, we just, okay. And we both liked alcohol at the time. So it was like, no problem at all. Yeah, we got it. And we just kept coming back, and I moved into his place probably 6 weeks after.
And they say lesbians.
Yeah, and it's like, oh my God, the 6 weeks is up, now what do I do? Yeah. It's like, okay. And we just made it permanent, and we're still sleeping in the same bed.
Good for you.
Awesome. Yeah. Right.
Thank you, Don. Who's next?
You. Well, okay, hi, my name is Dine, and I'm a newcomer. So I still have my headset of, like, Mexican. So I'm trying, you know, to relate to the conversation. But actually, I'm thinking, coming out to myself or coming out to other people? Because it took me a long time because of my environment, hostile, and very, very, very violent against LGBT people.
For sure.
So I was always thinking, because I was an exchange student. I was living in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And when I was there, when I was 16 years old, and I was there, and I was a heavy drinker. Because in Mexico, you, at that time, there was nothing else to do but drink. So so I was all the time drunk when I was a teenager. But I remember falling in love with my best friend. Mm-hmm. So I keep thinking to myself, I'm very sick. I'm a sick person. I keep always thinking of me as a sick person because I have not even one. I remember transgender women, one in where I come from, in my hometown, and she was trans, So it was nothing like lesbian, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I'm not that. You know, I'm not that. Because she was in a motorcycle.
Yeah.
She will be like a macho man. And so I did not understand that about women loving women at all.
Mm.
So I was in love with my best friend. So I was, every time I was drunk, I would do something weird, you know, like, I will cut my hair for you. I would say things like that, you know, and cut my hair short, you know, and next morning I was like, oh my God, you know. She didn't know I was in love, and I was with all this bad feeling, you know, oh my God. So
I had exactly the same thing, so go ahead.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Exactly.
So this is my internal dialogue for a long time, because then I went back to Mexico, and then I was like doing things. When I heard you, I keep laughing when you say you touch.
No.
You know, I kept that like a secret. You know, I was living in Mexico City, so the buses are very crowded. And I will just stand up so I can feel the body.
The accidentally on purpose touching me?
No, just by standing and the body's, because you are inside of the subway and you go like this, you know?
And just look forward, you don't see.
You know,
anything.
I don't do anything. Yes, I will just feel and I will say, oh my God, I'm so sick. You know, it's just because I was so happy and that was it. Yep. Until I understood there was a gay community, until I knew that you can go places, until I realized I wasn't the only one, you know. It's just,
no,
I know.
Hallelujah.
But actually, I was born in 1969, and I'm 53 now. So I was 20 years old when I realized there was an LGBT community, a very large in Mexico City.
Where was that?
Mexico City.
Oh, Mexico City. Oh, sorry.
Because I was from rural Mexico, but I went to study college in Mexico City. So, and that's another issue, you know, because it depends. In Mexico, the class issue is still very. It's like racism in other places, but it's classism.
Yeah.
So
it's more like the Indians. Excuse me. I'll try that. Southern Asian had the same thing.
The case
it used to be our East India. They have a class culture.
Yes.
And the same thing in Mexico.
Exactly the same. And still the same. You are rich. It doesn't matter your color.
No.
Your preference. Anything. If you are rich, you are white.
Yep.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
So I come from a white family, so you know. But I was like, if my parents find out about this, they will kick me out of the house, and they did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was like this on the movies, that my father would pay my private education and everything. When they find out, they kicked me out of the house. So I was in very bad conditions, because I didn't know how to work, or I didn't know, so it was bad. So that's what I was telling. What part? My inner dialogue or...
Oh, yeah.
You know,
so first you had to talk to yourself. And
yeah, well, yes, because I had to... When I realized it was a gay community, and then I started saying, I'm not sick, I'm just part... I'm a different...
Yeah.
It's just a sexual difference.
So we are the lucky ones. Welcome home.
Thank you. So that's my way of coming out to me or coming out to somebody else.
I grew up in Hong Kong. You didn't come out.
Oh.
Seriously.
Oh, my God.
So how are you here? How did you get here, then?
Moved here for job opportunity.
No, I mean out here.
Oh, here?
Yeah, not physically in... what's your trajectory?
Oh, just after moving to Halifax, kind of realized a couple of things and met a few people, and just always part of the community.
Just there.
Because
Halifax is the gay hub of the Maritimes.
For sure.
Yeah.
Everything
happens
here first and then spreads out.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, until I realized that, it was like, hey, you know, what's happening elsewhere? It doesn't.
What about St. John's, Newfoundland?
And then it's...
Is there anything happening in St. John's, Newfoundland?
A little bit.
No, just a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have two male friends that are married, and he's one of them is a church organist.
So that's so common. The gay church organist.
Yeah. And I know a really kinky guy and a real estate guy. It's like, yeah, next time I'm over, I get to go out in the woods with them. Mm. It's cool. Like, yeah.
Hunting.
So, yeah.
Is that what they call it?
So did you come to Halifax knowing that there might be a possibility of a community for you?
I came to Halifax knowing that there's probably going to be a job. Uh-huh. I didn't move out of Moncton for any other particular reason than
right.
employment.
I see.
It's just once I got here, you just meet the right people. Mm-hmm. You get along. Just do what you do to survive. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Part owner of a gay bar.
Yeah.
Over the years. That went nuts. Right. Mm.
Cool.
That was the one in Pizza Corner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that?
I don't think I ever went to that.
I don't.
When you're on Pizza Corner, with the old library back here, on this corner, there's a bar with a deck.
Yep, that's it.
It was called the 70s Pub and Eatery.
Oh,
it's been called a rooftop at some point too, wasn't it? You're talking about the one right above Sicilian.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But I'm talking. 2001.
I remember it was the Eagle, right? The Eagle moved from Dodgen Street to to our Dodgen.
Yeah, Jim McLeod was was the owner. Mm. And then one day, just hanging out at his place, having a beer in a bar, I said that I had seen something for rent in the paper, so we went. We had a look at it, and it was $4,000 a month. 3 days shy of losing three VLT machines, so we just hopped on that. Opened it up. It was the 70s Pub and Eatery. It was a beautiful bar. To me, I thought, we'll make money all day long selling food, restaurant. And then open in the evening for the gay bar crowd, or for the gay crowd, and or for anybody, right? And just close at about 10, 11, then feed our business down the corner to Reflections.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first thing that Jim did was he half-painted. This is kind of shitting on somebody, I'm sorry. But he kind of half ruined the look of the place. And, you know, within 3 nights, him drinking and other problems, right? Mm-hmm. If the gay community doesn't support me, I'm going to turn this into a straight bar. Well, there was a couple of gay people inside the bar, and that word got around like nuts being 25 years ago.
Mm.
And that place never stood a chance. Mm. Never stood a chance.
Yeah, it was short lived, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good location.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent.
I remember doing a scene up there once. Yeah. Strung out or something like that. Laid out or something.
Yeah, it was a nice
all
bar.
Tied down.
Dance floor.
Over the balcony,
oak and brass everywhere.
I remember,
Kitchen was in the basement. That place was just a license to print money. Jim had an issue that prevented coherent thinking at times, that cost money, that eventually I wasn't going to put in those thousands of dollars to buy the equipment. He was closed a couple of months later.
Yeah.
Good fellow, though. He was a serious part of the community, Jim.
Yeah, I was trying to think. Vortex in their basement.
They had Vortex.
Complete set of diningware. Ironstone or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, for the catering service. Because, I mean, you could have just, you know, like you say, you had the dining stuff down there, so it's like you could have just...
The kitchen was fabulous. The loading door was at the back. Down the guy.
Yep.
So, Dave, did you come out in St. John or Halifax?
Halifax.
So how did that go? I mean, how did you do it?
Details.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Oh, my God, we're gay.
So what are you saying? The move to Halifax just allowed you to be out as soon as you were here?
Sort.
Did you have to come out to your bosses or your...
No, because back then when you moved here, it was like it started the paper bag craze and, you know, that era, right? You didn't come out.
Yeah.
You just didn't.
Okay.
Like, I mean, if you want to work,
okay.
You know, get beat up at work. I mean,
one
place I ended up working after DND, of all places.
Oh, wow.
Like, I think you may know... And worked there for a couple of years, and then ended up working next door. And that's the last thing you wanted to be was a faggot. So you just kept yourself. And stuff.
Mm.
Yeah.
Who here hasn't done a coming out story? Go, Richard.
Well, there's parts of me now. There's about the whole getting kicked out of the church thing. But it really goes back to, I can look, people say, oh, it's a choice. BS. I can look back to grade one, grade two, elementary school, and I realized there's something, we had a really hot gym teacher. All of us Kings and Berwick's teachers came from Acadia, because they had the other way to the teachers' college, and you wound up in the city, you wound up in Acadia, who taught you to read education, you went to the valley schools. This gorgeous Mr. Carty, the gym teacher, straight on the street, but always had little shorts, barely covered anything up. This is back, like we're talking about the city, and I'm thinking, I like this. And of course, it took me, you know, along. And then my first time was when I was 13 with my best friend, who was a female's younger brother, who was like, he was 60 at the time. So yeah, that was, and that went on for a couple of years. But he was it was more of an experimental for him. It was just me, like, this is what I like, kind of thing. And it took, the other thing about I told my mother's best friend, girlfriend, she said, well, have we told your mom yet? I said, I'm coming to you first. And a lot of my friends knew it at this point. We're sort of free the high school bit. And so I told her, and she's like, all right, let's go visit mom. Because after the divorce, we're living in Wolfville at this point in time. So I ordered mom, and she said, oh, okay. She was like, oh, your son's got something to say. And she walked out of the room, and I'm going to kick your ass. And yeah, mom's like, I already know what you're going to tell me. You're gay. And I said, I'm pissed off at you. And I said, oh, great, here we go. And you told my girlfriend you didn't have the guts to tell your mother. I'm like, I can handle losing the respect of your friend. I could give a rat's ass, but she would. My mother, different stories. So, okay, next. My father. She remembers the situation. I was pissed off at you that you told my friend first. My father was a different, like, dad always kind of knew. I hated sports but I loved athletes. I could watch sports, but I couldn't catch a ball or frisbee or anything like that until many years later. And Dad never really talked about it. He's like, oh yeah, whatever, moving on. Not an issue. I'm an only child. And his really issue that he gave my father to me and my first partner, so at this point I was living in the city most of the time and coming back and forth to the valley. My dad picked me up one day in Halifax. I go to the valley and visit him. A long time ago, he said, I don't want to say what's going on, it's not my business, but your boyfriend's going to hurt you. Wow. That's as far as the conversation, so that's the first I'm going to say it. And the next day I caught him. Wow. And Dad's like, I warned you, but I wasn't going to tell you what was going on. Not my place to step in and say that. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I always say I was thanking Dad, but I said, that's the only thing ever want to talk. Yeah, and of course, I went into the Janet Con at the day in Kansas. Time. So yeah, like I knew growing up, we were going in high school. We did wet rescues was a big. We always went in grade 10, 11, 12. We went on class trips. We did Quebec townships. The ski was Mount Tremblant in grade 10. 11 was the Caribbean cruise and the Victory. What a garbage jump that cruise ship was! Carnival. What a dog in that thing that is. And the third thing was the gayest place in the world. My grade 12 year, Greece. Oh. Yeah. Wow. So we get off the plane, little guys, beautiful guys, dark hair, buff, with these little white dresses they have. I'm going to go, well, the military has got the dress with a little pom-pom on the shoes. I'm just going to go, yeah. The statues, I'm going, and we did Aegina, Poros, and Hydra as a tour. And I'm going to go, yeah, we're good. Get back to us, they're like, yeah, they clued in that I would have a little... They never said anything to me until I get back and land in Nova Scotia. It's like, chaperone, she's like, we always had fun with this one because her last name was Crook, my last name was Crook. So we always thought it was everybody said, oh, that must be your aunt. And I'm like, no, nothing to do with each other. So I hear you had a little fun while we're in Greece. I did. It was a lovely time. She looks at me going, honey, child. You and the bellhop were more than just friends. He was rather half helpful, yes. Chuckle, chuckle, chuckle. And then she came out a few years later, kind of thing. But yeah, and then I've never really had, except for that church thing, that I can recall, ever had a gay bash incident in my life. Hmm. And my partner did, to the point that he committed suicide.
Oh.
He's buried in Dartmouth.
Oh, God.
And it happened while I was in Toronto.
Mm.
And yeah, I come back and Well, his sister picks me up at the airport, and I'm like, why are you picking me up? Well, Matt's dead. Oh, this is before cell phones. We're talking late 90s. Ooh. And, he was never out, so the funeral was really awkward. The sisters knew. I just sat at the back of the ship. They're all living, and I go, you know, I'm just at the back, just a friend, you know, kind of thing. Mm. And interesting times, but pretty a good coming out experience, really.
I'll do my coming out story. That's the last thing.
Yes, okay. Okay.
9 minutes, and we want to say goodbye, so I'll mine as quickly as I can. So I was. My second serious relationship. First one was the boy in high school that was straight, and I was crazy about him, and I did nutty things when we were together. In hindsight, I knew because I was in love with him. But what I also realized is that best friend relationship is very much like a lover relationship, except without the sex. And so that's where we were for years, from the time we were in first year of senior high school, so when we were 15 years old? Something like from the time we were 15 to the time we were 19, we were inseparable.
Mm.
Wow.
Anyway, came out to him and that relationship ended. And then came to Halifax and met someone, and this is normal we're talking about.
Okay.
And fell in love, and I started seeing him a lot, and I was super proud of him, and because he was like a butch guy and good cook, and he was smart and all kinds of stuff. And I decided the first person I'm going to come out to is my brother. I'm just going to do just my brother. And so we invited my brother for a dinner party, and we had a fancy dinner party, and the silverware was out, and the crystal goblets were out, and we had like 6 courses of food, and it was fun, and lots of different kinds of wine, and everybody laughed, and we had a great time, and so this was the introduction, and it's like, well, this went perfectly. My brother was like laughed all evening, and obviously was okay with my partner, and I was proud of my partner. What a great time. And dinner party was over. My brother said goodbye. It was a 10-minute drive from our house, Norval and my house, to my brother's house. So he could get home in 10 minutes. 12 minutes after he left, my phone rang, and it was my mom saying, Gary says that you're living with a house full of fags. My brother helped me come out.
Wow.
Push off the cliff.
It worked out absolutely perfectly.